Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Before diving into today's discussion, I have a few housekeeping items to brush up on. First, I want to remind folks that our podcast is sponsored by Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion. If you go to their website, www.baylorisr.org, you will be able to get free access to a wide range of academic research on religion that is designed to be accessible to the general public. It is a great resource for building your knowledge base, so please do pay them a visit. We will post a link to their website on our website. Second, I would like to remind folks that we have a Facebook fan page where we post notes about upcoming episodes as well as my thoughts on some of the interviews. We currently are at 264 fans, and I would like to get that to 300 since the folks at the Institute for Studies of Religion tell me that if I don't reach that landmark soon, they are going to come to my house and steal our new puppy dog.
Oh my God!
No, not really, Jeremy. I'm just kidding. But I would like to make it to 300 likes in the next month anyway. So please, for the sake of the puppy, click on the Facebook icon on the far right column on the front page of our website, or search for Research on Religion with Anthony Gill on Facebook. To incentivize you further, I will be putting up a trivia question regarding today's interview on the Facebook fan page. The first person who answers it correctly and who lives within the United States or Canada will receive an autographed copy of my most recent book, The Political Origins of Religious Liberty. Previous guests of the show are not eligible, and you must be 18 or older to play, or not drinking a 20-ounce soda in New York City. I apologize to our listeners in Europe, Asia, Africa, and Latin America, but our show budget excludes international postage beyond the Great White North. All right, on with today's show. It is now the middle of summer in 2012, and lots of you are on vacation at the beach or in your mountain cabins, and you don't have much access to the news. Nonetheless, as regular subscribers to this podcast, which you can get free on iTunes, I am betting that you would like to stay properly informed of all the doings and happenings that are going on in the world of religion. So to help you out there, I'm enlisting the help of one of our former guests, Jeremy Lott, who is the editor of Real Clear Religion and Real Clear Books. Both are news portals and a blogging site that provides a great deal of information on religion, stuff, and junk. He also posts his thoughts and musing on his daily diary at patheos.com and is the author of a number of books, including In Defense of Hypocrisy, Picking Sides in the War on Virtue, The Warm Bucket Brigade, The Story of the American Vice Presidency, I'll Never Forget It, Memoirs of a Political Accident from East Baltimore, and the biography William F. Buckley, part of the Christian Counter series from Thomas Nelson Press. For those of you who think books are so 20th century, you can catch the rhymes and reasons of this prolific writer in a number of different sources around the intertubes, including patheos.com, the Financial Times, the Guardian, and the American Prospect. We'll make sure that we link to his books as well as his blog on Patheos on our website. He also fashions himself as a mighty fine bowler, but he has not yet met the likes of me, and I can almost bowl a 200 game if you handicap me about 112 points. Jeremy, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Always happy to be here, Tony.
Oh, that's great. Hey, one thing on your bio, and I read this off, I think, the patheos.com site, it says that you're a ghost writer, too. So are you the guy who actually helped to write the new Batman movie, The Dark Knight Rises?
I can't really say.
Yeah, see, that's exactly what I would expect a ghostwriter of that movie to say. It's kind of like a dark secret ninja can never tell us that they are. So, okay. Have you ghost written a number of books, right?
I was the recognized ghost of Marvin Mandel's autobiography, and let's just say that I've written for quite a few of our nation's most prestigious talk show hosts.
Very interesting.
I will not recognize.
Very interesting. Well, we'll keep that a secret. All right, So here's what we're going to do today. I emailed Jeremy a couple days ago and asked him to be on the show once again and talk about some of the recent events in the news and or world of religious scholarship. And so we picked out a couple topics and we'll devote a bit of time to each of them before bouncing randomly to some unrelated topic. I was going to have a bell to move us along to the next phase, but you know what? I forgot that bell downstairs. So we're
which
just going
to have good because, you know, I haven't eaten anything today, which is making me hungry.
Oh, yeah. See, I told Jeremy I was going to bring our dinner bell up for that. And every time I ring, it would be like a Pavlov dog or something like that. But I forgot to do that. I was making a run out to the dump today and forgot to do that. So, all right. Hey, let's get on with the topics here. Our first topic can be summed up in one word: the Episcopal Church in the United States of America. I guess that's actually nine words, but if you say it really fast, then it does come out like one word.
The Episcopal Church in the United States of America.
There you go. See, that's one word there. So, you know, no matter. Those Episcopalians, wow, that's hard to pronounce. Those Episcopalians, recently they had a big confab, and I think they hold this every 2 or 3 years, and that gathering made a lot of noise in the press. So, Jeremy, what is going on with these Episcopalians?
Well, yeah, that's the interesting part. They meet every 3 years, and at this convention, they, among other things, they said that bishops cannot discriminate against transsexuals for if you have a call to the ministry. Not only in the sense that, you know, certain people have legitimate biological problems, but you know, for instance, if I were to decide to show up to the local bishop wearing a wig and a push-up bra, and he turned me away, I could make the Episcopal version of a federal case out of it.
Oh, okay. Well, I got a question on that, though. I mean, how many pastors would actually turn people away like that? I don't think that's their normal job, right? They minister to everybody.
Well, no. I mean, this is if you were to come and say, I want to be a priest.
Oh, if you want to be a priest in the Episcopal Church. Okay. Yeah. All right. What else?
They also have rights for pet funerals.
Pet funerals, yes, that was a big one. I heard about that too, though. They're going to have specific rights for pet funerals.
I guess it's true that all dogs do go to heaven.
I do. I hope so, because I want to roam and romp around with our dog in heaven too. So I might have to become Episcopalian because Methodists might not send their dogs to heaven. I'm not sure. Yeah. Okay, so they got transgender folks can become priests. Pets can go to heaven.
There's going to be, they want all the bishops to, or all of the priests to be able to bless same-sex unions, but what they did say is that if you have a conservative bishop, he can say no in his diocese.
Okay.
Or whatever the Episcopal term for diocese is.
So they gave an escape clause for some of the congregations.
Yeah, and I think two of them are going to exercise that option.
Okay. I guess they're probably a little bit worried that some of the their parishes or dioceses are going to be skipping out of the Anglican communion like many people or like many congregations have been doing in the past. So that that can be a big deal.
Well, I mean, the Vatican has made a special order for integrating Anglicans and by, you know, extension Episcopalians into the church. And we don't know what effect this will have on that because there's already been some amount of exodus to sort of a North American non-Episcopalian Anglican diocese. Mm-hmm. I'm not making them up. That actually exists.
Wait, what was that again? Repeat that.
I don't know what the exact term is, but it's a North American non-Episcopalian Anglican diocese that's overseen by African bishops.
Okay.
So basically you have that already exists on the Anglican side, and then the Pope has put together a ex-Anglican order that they can join as well. One of the problems is that if congregations decide that they want to convert en masse, they end up losing their historic good-looking churches, and the, you know, the leadership of the church will seize it and sell it in some cases to, I mean, I think one of them became a mosque.
Yeah, that is actually a big deal when it comes to this. Many people think, well, if a congregation just wants to up and leave, it's pretty easy. You just say, hey, we're no longer Episcopalians or what have you. But yeah, there's this property attached to this. And as soon as a congregation leaves, there's big arguments and court battles about, you know, who owns this chunk of land and these buildings and the pews and the even down to the Bibles.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's a huge property dispute if they do it. It's a rather large pain.
Yeah. I can see that that would have some, create barriers of exit to some of these congregations that are thinking of going here. And that's actually become a big problem with the Episcopalians recently, because they've had, if I'm correct, in the past decade or so, they've had a 23% decline in membership or weekly attendance. And that's a pretty serious drop within just 10 years.
And significant declines before that. It's a real problem.
Yeah.
Philip Jenkins, he does blogs occasionally on Pathios. He works at Baylor, actually, and he said, you know, how long can this persist numerically? You know, just, I don't think that the Episcopal Church can be self-sustaining, you know, several decades out from now.
Yeah, I remember reading that column. We'll put a link up to that column, because he mentions that he's an Episcopal as well.
Yeah.
Or he attends an Episcopal church. And so he's noticed. Another guy who has noticed this too, and it created a big, huge stir on the interwebs, was this guy, Ross Douthat. I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
Ross Douthat.
Okay, Douthat. Do you know him at all?
Oh, yeah. We've had lunch, et cetera.
Oh, you've had lunch. What'd you have for lunch?
Some sort of a squash soup, if I remember right.
Okay. That sounds like, a squash soup sounds like something that somebody from the New York Times would eat. But, he wrote an op-ed on the Episcopal Church entitled, "Can Liberal Christianity Be Saved?" And as I mentioned, that just got the blogosphere up in arms, and different people saying yes and no and maybe and who knows. So I'm going to pose that question to you. You follow this stuff a lot. You've had squash soup with Ross. So can the Episcopal Church be saved?
You know, I don't know. They have to be able to attract more members, and I don't know how they do that. You know, one of the problems is that the people who agree with them politically, you know, aren't as likely to agree with them on the God question, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a real problem. It's the liberal Christianity faces a long-term problem in that it's, and this isn't, you know, unique to Episcopalians. I mean, there are a lot of mainline denominations that have undergone quite a bit of decline at the same time as they've liberalized. You've seen this, well, with Presbyterians, you've seen this to a lesser extent with Methodists, but in Methodists' case, you've actually had a very serious pushback over the last few years because they're governed differently, where you have all these conservative Africans who are pushing the denomination back in a more conservative direction.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how the Episcopal Church is governed, and so that hasn't affected them.
Yeah, it is interesting to see a lot of the denominations, or I should say congregations of some of these denominations, these liberal mainline denominations that exist in the developing world in Africa, Latin America, or Asia, actually tend to be a lot more conservative theologically than these other churches. And you see this divide, which is interesting, because a lot of these liberal mainline churches like to state that they're very progressive and have a big concern for the developing world, and yet they're coming to headbutts with these folks in the developing world.
Yeah, no, it's quite interesting, and the Episcopalians, you know, they do run into some problems because they're part of a broader Anglican communion. So whenever they go to the annual Lambeth Conference in England, then they can get pushed around a little bit, but that doesn't happen very often.
Okay. In terms of this, do you think any of this stuff that came out of this recent conference that they had, where they're, you know, focusing on pet funerals and they're focusing on same-sex unions and a few other things like that, rather than really addressing head-on the issue of why attendance is declining, do you think that's going to lead to further bleeding of this denomination?
I mean, I think that the trends are already set, but they haven't done anything to reduce the trends. One of the things that people punched back at Ross Douthat over his column, and they said, well, there's been decline among, for instance, Southern Baptists, or, you know, this isn't unique to Episcopalians, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here's the problem, though. A lot of the decline among, say, Southern Baptists is people leaving from a church that is denominated a Southern Baptist and going to the local community church that is theologically, in another way, similar to Southern Baptists. The denomination can undergo some amount of decline, but you're not seeing a huge bleed off in the number of people that are like that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas just the number of sort of self-identified progressive Christians just continues to dwindle year to year, and I don't know how you reverse that trend.
Yeah, I've always wondered about this, because when it comes to businesses, say, that sell secular products like hamburgers or cans of soup or some other type of business that sells some kind of widget, when their business starts declining, when they see a market share decline, they oftentimes look around and say, okay, hey, what's wrong with our business model? Let's take a look at some of the more successful businesses that are out there and let's try to adopt best practices. You know, well, that place is using some kind of internet marketing technology. Maybe we better get on board with that. And so you tend to see the business world shifting in ways that the religious world is not. I mean, for me, it's just somewhat mind-blowing that the Episcopalians are saying, oh, yeah, we lost 23% of our attendance in the past decade. But, you know, oh, well, that happens. We'll just kind of keep moseying on as we are doing it. Isn't there any incentive out there to take a look at some of the growing denominations, some of these non-denominational churches or mega churches or, you know, Pentecostals that seem to be doing pretty well and say, hey, maybe they got something that we should be doing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, let's have some holy rolling Episcopalians.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, with businesses, it's a mixed bag, right? Because some businesses adapt and others die, right?
Yeah.
And I think you can see the same sort of thing in religion over sort of a longer term. You know, some, like I think Methodists, for instance, their decline hasn't been as steep. And I think that they could, you know, potentially push back, you know, come back from the brink. That's possible.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, you know, you can get to a point where, How do you call it back? How do you reverse it? I mean, the trend lines are just too far in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
You know, I hope that's not the case here, but it's possible.
Yeah, I'm also wondering, too, to the extent that you got theologians here who've invested their whole life in thinking in these different ways, and they say, no, we can't become Pentecostals because that's just wrong. I mean, to say that when you're a Episcopal priest at age 55 would be to admit that everything that's happened, you know, in your last 30 years of being a minister is worthless, right?
Oh, okay. I guess. I don't know. Or you could, you know, it's a new revelation. It's
yeah.
Part of the moving of the Holy Spirit. I don't know. I mean, it can be, the circle can be squared, but you have to be willing to do it.
I think there's a big opening for anybody who wants to do more research on that. As you mentioned, that you're thinking about Holy Roller Episcopalians. I've noticed that there's been a movement within the Catholic Church as well as charismatic Catholics.
Yeah.
Who, I mean, the Catholic Church seems very adept at adapting to some of these new, you know, I don't want to call them trends, or basically, you know, providing spaces for different flavors of Catholicism with under their big umbrella. But some of these other denominations, the Episcopals, just don't seem to be able to do that very well. I mean, obviously they're trying with saying, okay, certain congregations, if you want to opt out of this rule, you can. But, you know, I don't know writ large if they're successful at that.
I mean, sort of to bring it back to the business thing, I kind of understand a little bit of why they don't want to do it. I mean, the whole idea of the sort of Anglican Episcopal thing was that we're Catholic without the Pope, you know, and we are a certain thing. And I understand how they don't want to change, but then they, in every other way, changed. So who knows?
Yeah. Hey, well, this is about where I'd ring the dinner bell right now to move on to our next topic.
Hungry.
You are hungry. You want some of that squash soup, I can tell.
Yeah.
Hey, but this is a related topic, so it kind of still is flowing with our conversation here. Our good friend Timothy Dalrymple published a piece on Pathos.com regarding a recent Pew Foundation study that reported the retention rates of various religious denominations. So again, this is, you know, dealing with what's happening with the Episcopals. They're all leaving. What is happening here? And the Pew Foundation study actually did for Christian denominations, Catholic, and a variety of Protestant denominations. They also did for some non-Christian ones as well. And Timothy was prompted by one of his friends who saw the report, who asked whether or not Protestants should be pushing the panic button based upon this research that showed that denominations like the Baptists, they're only able to retain 60% of the kids that grew up in a Baptist household and then become adults. So basically what this report was saying is that if you grew up in a Baptist household, you have a 6 and 10 chance of staying Baptist, which means you have a 4 and 10 chance of leaving. 40% is a pretty big attrition rate here. And so Lutherans, they looked at Lutherans too. Lutherans lost about 41% of their kids, so similar to Baptists. Methodists lost 54% of their kids. And then those associated with a Congregationalist church lost a whopping 63%, almost two-thirds of somebody who was raised in a Congregationalist household ended up leaving by the time that they were adults. And so, you know, his friend said, oh my gosh, Protestants should be really freaking out about this. But Timothy Dalrymple made a really good point. He said, you look way down at the bottom of this list of retention rates. And he said, if you look at atheists, they're dead last. And in fact, only 30% of kids raised in an atheist home remained an atheist in their adult life. And he made the argument that it should be the atheists that are actually pushing the panic button. And I mean, I'm going to link to that post for viewers to read that on our website. But have you given any thought to this at all?
Yeah, I mean, it goes into what I said earlier. At least some of what you had here is you have a lot of Baptist kids going to churches that are Baptist in everything but name, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
The bleed is when you actually look at sort of inner Protestantial, I don't know, leeway, it's not nearly as huge as it sounds. But the atheist thing, one of the problems there is you just have such a small sample. I mean, only, say, 2 to 3% of Americans are actually, you know, affirmatively atheists.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to gauge based on that small sample.
Yeah, I'd have to look and see if the Pew Foundation actually oversampled them a little bit, because those results may not be statistically significant. But even, you know, looking at that, you could even up the number a little bit and say half of the atheists are not remaining atheists later in life, which is, it's surprising.
For a lot of people, it's a miserable way to live. To live your life as if there isn't a God. You know, some people, that's great for them. It works for them just perfectly. But a lot of us, you know, get to a point in our lives where, no, we actually kind of need God.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that that's true of, the children of atheists as well as the children of religious people.
Yeah, it's interesting to note as well, because there's been a lot of hubbub in the news over the past couple of years about the growing number of nuns, N-O-N-E-S, people who are not affiliated with religion. A lot of people associate this with a growing rate of atheism or agnosticism. But what this Pew Foundation seems to be cutting in the opposite direction, that unless atheists have families of 9 or 10 kids, their attrition rate...
I wouldn't count on that one.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't think so either, right? It's Mormons and other, you know, stricter denominations that tend to have a lot more kids. It's, you know, atheists actually should be shrinking in some regard, which is this Pew Foundation report really surprised me. If they only have a 30% retention rate, even if they have a 50% retention rate, I still think that's amazing to actually see that.
Yeah. By the way, I've been thinking about this nuns, Tony. Can I sort of share with you my thoughts about this?
Yeah.
Philip Jenkins has posited the idea that the reason that America is so much more religious than, say, Europe is that we're a much more mobile country,
mm-hmm.
and religion is a really good way of quickly integrating people into communities, and that's the sort of the genius of the American religious thing, is that it's been willing to travel with people, and you've gone through periods where, you know, in the Wild West or whatever, where people weren't very churched, and then churches got there and did their job and helped to welcome new people in, and they became much more churched much more quickly, right?
Right.
And if you kind of look at the demographic trends in this country over the last, let's say, 20 years or so, actually, let's broaden it out a little bit beyond that. I mean, you had people fleeing cities into this, we're going back to the 70s here, you had people fleeing the cities into the suburbs, and religion grew like crazy in the suburbs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the exurbs and everything else. And as a result, it kind of emptied out of the cities. I mean, a lot of churches had to close down and that sort of thing. And if you look at the kids these days, the demographic trends you're seeing is a lot of them are moving back to cities where there are fewer churches now, because the churches went with the people in the suburbs and the exurbs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes sense that it would be harder to church them. And the other thing is that the going back to this idea of mobility, in Europe, people just don't move around that much, right? Mm-hmm. You tend to live kind of close to where you grew up, and it's all quite cramped. And if you look at the millennials and whatnot these days, they're not doing, like, they don't drive cars as much. They're not moving. They moved into the cities, and they're just kind of staying there. And there aren't a lot of churches to integrate them, and they're sort of integrating themselves because, you know, they're just staying put.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would stand to reason that they would be less churched.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting thesis on there. I have a slightly different take, and I thought you were going to go in a different direction where you're talking about mobility, is that given that we are a nation that moves around quite a bit, there's a lot of mixing that goes on, right? If you think about the old days, 100 years ago, everybody was in their ethnic community. You had Irish Catholics, and you had Scottish Presbyterians and German Lutherans. But, you know, with the advent of the freeway system or the highways in the 1950s and 1960s, cars become much more accessible and cheaper for everybody to buy. We do see this moving to the suburbs and the exurbs, and it stands to reason that a church that wants to attract people, a church that plants itself out there, is not going to say, well, we're a German Lutheran congregation, because there's going to be some Scottish Presbyterians or, you know, English Anglicans that are in the mix as well. And so I'm writing a paper on this now, that these non-denominational churches, this trend in non-denominationalism that we see growing nowadays, is because of this mobility. It doesn't make sense to brand yourself as a specific denomination. You just say, hey, we're a Christian community church. We're in the town of Duval, so, you know, come out to our Christian church in Duval. And people say, well, what denomination are you? So you say Christian. And when it comes back to this whole issue of how people identify themselves, you call them up on the phone and you have this old survey that you said that says, well, what denomination are you? Episcopalian, Congregationalist, Lutheran, Baptist? And somebody in this community church says, well, none. I'm not any of that.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think they have a category necessarily for, you know, just somebody who goes to church, you know, a church goer or a Christian goer. So I don't know.
Some surveys try to do that. Gallup, for instance, has a generic Christian thing now. But, it's clear that there has been some fall off among millennials in church attendance. And I kind of think that some of that is related to, you know, where they're moving to and how they're staying put. It's not the whole picture, but I think that's part of it.
No, it is interesting. To the extent that they're going back to cities, and for me, a country guy here, I'm astounded that anybody would move back to a city.
Oh,
but
yeah, it's insane.
Yeah, absolutely. And I say, okay, great, they're moving back there. But yeah, the churches that I know in downtown Seattle tend to be the old Methodist church that has that musty smell to it, and the pastor, the minister there is about 105 years old. And I mean, if you're a 25-year-old, you know, hipster, you go into that and say, whoa, I don't know. Maybe that's the reason why, like, a Mars Hill, which is springing up in Seattle, is having such success among that age group, is because they are not providing the old, you know, musty hymnal kind of service.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing, too, I had to mention about that, too, is in terms of the atheists or people leaving, but the switching, you see, and you made this point very clear, too, is that, you know, when a Baptist leaves a Baptist church, they go somewhere else. They go to maybe a Methodist church, but maybe the community church, the brand new community church. And so they're not necessarily leaving the faith. And I think that's what Timothy was really trying to point out in his article, is that, you know, when the Baptist church cannot retain a Baptist, they actually are going somewhere else. And actually a Methodist might be becoming a Baptist. So you're not seeing new converts in that regard. Whereas
one of the things with non-denominational churches,
yeah,
people say, I go to a non-denominational church or a community church. And you go, well, what kind? Right?
Yeah.
And a lot of times you'll get, well, it's kind of like a Baptist church.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it's kind of like a Reformed church or something like that.
Yeah, some of these actually are denominationally based, but they hide their affiliation. That's
another trend.
Yeah, I call these covert denominations, like Saddleback. You know, ask somebody off the street, what denomination Saddleback is. Oh, no, they're just Saddleback. Well, no, they're Southern Baptist.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't see that in their building. Well, yeah, you know, so.
It's in the fine print.
Yeah. So, yeah, so Timothy made a good point, and we'll link to that article again as well. Again, I'm surprised by the atheism thing because, in part, an atheist can't go to another atheist denomination. If you leave atheism, you probably got to go to a faith-based thing. So that, I think Timothy put his finger on that right, and that it should be the atheists who are panicking by that Pew study. Hey, and speaking of atheists, though, you just went to a book signing by Kaya Oakes. I think that's how you pronounce her name. And she recently published a book that's getting a lot of splash now called Radical Reinvention, An Unlikely Return to the Catholic Church. Now, I haven't read this book. I think it's been out about a month or so. But you really seem to be taken by it. So give us the lowdown on who Kaya Oakes is and why she returned to the Catholic Church and from where.
Well, that's sort of the question. Kaya Oakes, she lives in Oakland. She teaches at a university there. I think it's one of the UCal universities. She's written a couple of books. She's a poet and a chronicler of, among other things, hip-hop, I believe. And so I was at the local, independent bookstore, and I saw that she was coming to speak. And so I grabbed her book, Radical Reinvention, An Unlikely Return to the Catholic Church. And started reading it. Now, I've not finished reading it yet, but on Sunday, I posted a thing that said, I've read, 60-some-odd pages of this book, and here are some sort of problems I have so far. Oakes, her dad was Catholic, and her mom was essentially a sort of progressive teacher type that I don't know if she had a faith to speak of. And Oakes, kind of had a tug-of-war childhood between the two and abandoned the, wasn't even fully confirmed. And so she was sort of half-Catholic growing up and sort of went on about her life. And then later in life, she decided that she did believe in God, and the God she believed was not sort of the liberal Episcopalian God or something. He was actually the Catholic God.
Mm-hmm.
And so she decided to come back to the Catholic Church. But the problem is that her politics and the church's politics are, let us say, two different things.
Mm-hmm.
She's very progressive and just on a whole host of moral issues, just really very much dissents from what the church has to say. And so, the ongoing question I have in reading this book is, so why is she Catholic?
Yeah.
And the answer she advances is, look, I just sort of feel Catholic. I'm Irish. This is my people. And also, there's just sort of this deep longing to just be part of this community. I can understand all of that. And so she calls herself, sort of a cafeteria Catholic. And the question that I posed on my Pathias blog is, I said, look, I don't really care that she calls herself a cafeteria Catholic. That's whatever it is. But the problem I have in sort of reading how she's approaching these issues is that she's sort of inventing a cafeteria morality as she goes. She sort of starts with this presumption that I'm pretty okay and goes from there in constructing, saying that the church is wrong and I'm right. And, I just think that's a really horrible thing to do. I don't think that's the right approach. I don't think you should, construct a morality based on, justifying yourself. It's just a horrible idea. I mean, that's one of the reasons I wrote my book in defense of hypocrisy,
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, hypocrisy is all about a sort of affirming necessary moral beliefs while carving out wiggle room to sort of live our lives. But you don't, these beliefs and these ideals are important things that you have to respect and deal with and, pay some heed to. I guess you're just sort of seeing our completely opposite worldviews coming head to head here.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting, because I know that there's been a number of people that have been converting back to Catholicism, some because they like the rigor of the theology of the Catholic Church, but others, Kaya Oakes here, it seems that she's neglecting 2,000 years of church history and saying, okay, let's start anew when I'm back, so let's rebuild the church. And one would wonder, why didn't she go to...
Yeah, it's sort of like the pink approach to Catholicism, I'm coming out, so we better get this party started.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting. Why wouldn't she have gone to the Episcopal Church? Did you have a chance to ask her that at all?
No, that's the thing. She canceled her book signing.
She canceled her book signing. You know, I wouldn't do that. If I had a book signing up there in Bellingham, Washington, I would show up. So I could get on there. I should have taken her place then. But nobody ever asked me to do book signings.
That would have been much more interesting.
Yeah. So that'd be interesting. I might have to get her show. It's a similar story, too, to what I saw recently on Pathios. I think this was Leah Librescu, who was the atheist writer for the atheist portal on Pathos.com. About a month ago, maybe 2 months ago now, came out with what she said was, "This is my last column on the atheist portal because I'm now a believer." And that shook the whole world too. And again, it kind of goes back with this Pew retention rate of that, oops, there's another atheist that the atheist group just lost. So do you happen to know anything about her at all and how it might connect with Kaya or anything?
Just to go back to the communitarian thing we were talking about earlier. Leah, she was doing a blog called Unequally Yoked, and she had a Catholic boyfriend. So she took up the atheist blog for Pathos and just ended up interacting with lots and lots and lots of Christians, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this had a effect on her in the sense that she realized that these people were really nice people, and so she was moved by that. But then just as she kept going, she just realized, well, wait a minute, maybe I don't not believe.
Yeah.
And so she is, you know, converting to Catholicism now.
Again, Catholicism, which again is very interesting. And that's, for any, you know, graduate students or people thinking of going to graduate studies or people who are scholars there looking for a new topic to study, this movement back to the Catholic Church is absolutely fascinating. And I don't know if there is anybody out there doing that research now, but I keep running into a lot of people who are doing that thing, not only from atheism, but, you know, from Baptists and Methodists. So that's kind of interesting that, Leah is doing that. Do you know Leah personally?
I don't know her personally.
Okay.
No.
But you're on the same website, so that's kind of neat. So she went through this whole, you know, rethinking of her life. She had a moral quandary that she was wrestling with. And now this is part of the interview where I like to help my guests work through some moral quandary that they found themselves in recently. And, you know,
I had a bad one.
You had a bad one. I know. So this is, I read about it on your blog. And so this is where I get to play Dr. Phil. And I know some people are saying, "Whoa, wait, Toy, you've never done that before." And I say, "No, I usually only reserve that for the second time Jeremy Locke comes on our show." So go ahead and tell us what your big moral quandary was.
Okay. I mow the lawn at my parents' place because I like doing it and because my dad's knees are kind of bad.
Yeah, that's a nice thing to do. That doesn't seem like a big moral problem.
But yet. I basically use his bad knees as an excuse to mow the lawn.
Okay. Do you like mowing lawns?
I love mowing the lawn.
Man. You got to come out to my place.
It's the most zen thing I could imagine.
Okay. Okay, cool.
And so, you know, as I'm mowing the lawn, I'm mowing past our neighbor's yard that we don't have a fence there or anything. And I keep thinking, you know, just I have this, like, urge to go mow their front lawn as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem I have is, you know, it's their property, their lawn. I don't think they particularly object, but I know if when I was in their shoes, I would object because I really like mowing the lawn.
Yeah.
And so I've thought about, you know, knocking on their door and saying, "Can I mow your front lawn?" But that just seems awkward.
Yeah, that does. That seems like, "Boy, your house is really ugly. Can I help paint it for you?"
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is, in Linden, I mean, lawns are a big deal. It's like a sign of Republican virtue and divine election. And, you know, I might be implying something about them accidentally.
Yeah. So have you mowed their lawn yet?
I've done it a few times when they're out of town because, you know, on something or other. But I've never done it while they're here.
Okay.
And one sort of sneaky thought I had was maybe I could just mow it and say, "Well, you know, I accidentally mowed into your yard, and I didn't want to just leave a patch there, so I went and did the whole thing."
Yeah.
Which would technically be true, because the boundary between our two houses is pretty, you know, I mean, you'd have to get a surveyor to get it exactly right.
Yeah, no, that is the same thing with our lawn, too, and I occasionally cut into my neighbor's lawn. I said, "Oh, I better, you know, mow it." He does the same thing, so our boundary line, you know, according to lawn mowing, it changes, you know, depending who got to the shaggy lawn first. Well, you know, I saw that on your blog post, and I really felt for you. I mean, it is kind of a traumatic moral thing that I think the likes of Plato and Aristotle and Derrida have all wrestled with before. But here's the solution I came up with, and let me know if this would work for you. I was thinking, go ahead and mow your neighbor's lawn, not only when they're gone, but when they're there as well. And then what you should do, because you feel guilty about, you know, doing it for them and that's something they should be doing, what you could do is you could sell or send them the bill for your services rendered. You know, figure out an hourly rate for yourself. And then you someday just, you know, in a couple of weeks show up with, you know, bring along some kind of orphan kid, like, you know, Oliver Twist or something out of a Dickens novel with a little cap and a burlap, you know, bag for that. And bring a video camera along too. And then you go up to the door and you can have the kid say, "Hi, I've been mowing your lawn. I'm here to collect the payment." And I'm sure your neighbor is going to say, "I'm not paying you for that." And once you get that on video, man, that is just like NBC News kind of stuff. And you will see donations just flow into you. What do you think?
You know, you might have just come up with a get-rich-quick scheme.
Yeah, no, that's what I was thinking. I was just like, I got to get my kid to look all sad sack and stuff like that. So hopefully your father's neighbor is not a listener to Research on Religion. So then he would figure out what our scam is already. So anyways, that's... But I think other than that, you're just going to have to resolve that on your own here. So anyways, I want to get back to something a little bit more serious and one that really does relate to an ongoing philosophical struggle and something that relates to religious freedom that I know you wanted to talk about. And I'm talking here about the recent Health and Human Services mandate that came down from the Secretary Kathleen Sebelius as part of the Affordable Care Act that's also known as Obamacare. Now, we've discussed this in the past with a couple of our guests, including Philip Munoz and the Reverend Robert Chirico. But that was before the Supreme Court decision came out calling the mandate a tax, which really shifted the whole nature of this debate. And Obamacare...
Well, most people assumed, and they were right to assume this, because John Roberts hadn't done what he did, if this would have been accurate, that the first mandate that would require could require individuals to purchase insurance would be deemed unconstitutional. And that this would have the effect of scuttling a lot of Obamacare. They'd have to go back, at the very least, and rethink a lot of this and pass, new legislation that would deal with this new reality.
And it almost seemed like a would have been the safe judicial choice, because you tell the legislature, listen, it's not our job to be messing with this, but this is really convoluted. Try it again.
Yeah, I obviously would have favored that approach. But the thing is, there are actually two mandates, and the second mandate, which, you know, wasn't at issue here, was is it constitutional for the administration to require religious institutions to purchase health insurance that includes funding for things that violate their core beliefs?
Yeah.
Obviously, contraceptives, abortifacients, abortions, sterilization, you know, you get the idea.
Right. Things that the Catholic bishops don't like too much.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not just, so you have all these Catholic colleges now saying, guys, this is a problem because, you know, we're not allowed to fund this for our employees for a darn good reason, in the sense that the bishops won't let us do that and call ourselves Catholic. And, this isn't just the Catholic colleges. That Wheaton, for instance, the evangelical school, recently filed and said, well, you know, we're not down with paying for a lot of this either. So, and we think that this violates our religious freedom. And so now you're going to have, this could bubble up in a year or so and result in another Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, and that's what is really interesting about this, because Obamacare now is constitutional, but there are these other lawsuits out there, and again, the past lawsuit didn't deal with the contraception mandate, which came up while the court was in session and wrestling with these issues, and so it's kind of interesting, because I know that the Catholic Church and a number of evangelical groups actually created something called the Fortnight of Freedom to press this issue, saying, you know, this is a huge deal when it comes to religious freedom. You're making us do things that are against our conscience, and, you know, that's not what the Constitution says you can do. So what's your read on the situation? Do you think this will make it to the court, and do you think the court will then use that as a reason for overturning the Affordable Care Act, or do you think it'll only be partially?
I think it depends on the outcome of this election, because if Obama loses, it's moot. Because the first bill that the House would pass and that Romney would eventually sign would be a repeal of the Obamacare.
Yeah, but he would need the Senate to do that too, though.
My sense is, if you even got close to enough senator, or if you got a Romney elected and you got even, let's say, a 49-51 Democratic majority, you could still force it through. Because there is actually enough Democrats that have gone on record as saying that, you know, they would favor a repeal of at least parts of this.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, and it would just be this huge repudiation. I mean, what we thought was that there was, we were going to, the Supreme Court was going to take a whack at this, and then they were going to return some of it to the political process, and, you know, we'll sort of sort it out as we go. What instead has happened, from a political point of view, is the Supreme Court has taken a pass, and this is all up to an election to determine how this goes.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the first consideration. Then the second one is, okay, so Obama wins. If that's the case, then you know, this lawsuit will go forward, and what will the Supreme Court do? My sense is they actually might side with a lot of these colleges and whatnot, because my guess is Roberts at that point would pivot and side with the four conservatives on the court. But that assumes a lot of things, including that the makeup of the court will stay the same over the next year. I'm not convinced of that, or next, you know, year and a half.
Yeah.
I'm not convinced of that. It just assumes too much.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting, too, because as the court was hearing arguments against the Affordable Care Act and in favor of the Affordable Care Act, this whole thing with the bishops was starting to come up at that point in time. And I said, you know, I know the justices read the paper, and they know that this is a storm cloud that's on the horizon here. So, again, I was quite surprised to see that Roberts, you know, sided with the liberal justices and said, oh, no, this thing is constitutional if you declare it a tax, because, again, there's a big storm on the horizon related to this, and the Wheaton College jumping in on this in the last couple of weeks is only an indication that it's actually going to get bigger. I'm just wondering if Justice Roberts, when he hears this case, and if he hears this case, is going to declare contraception as a tax.
There you go.
Yeah, I know. So, you know, there you go. I go to the store and get some taxes for that. All right. Hey, here's one other thing that you wanted to talk about. Actually, there's a couple things, but I want to bring this one up. And you wanted to talk about something Mormon. And that sounds pretty reasonable, since that this is likely going to be a thing in the upcoming presidential campaign. Now, I have to quote you from our last podcast. You said you never wanted to hear the phrase Mormon moment again. But I know. Here we are talking about the Mormon moment. And what impact do you think that Mormonism is going to be in this upcoming presidential campaign?
Well, first of all, you're going to see a watershed of evangelicals suddenly deciding that they can work with Mormons.
Uh-huh.
You're going to see anti-Mormonism on the rise among Democrats for some weird reason.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, like, politics very much affects the way we think of a lot of things, and that's what's going to happen here. You know, Mormons are going to I think that this will sort of deeply entrench. I mean, Mormons are already the most Republican voting bloc, but I mean, they will, I think, become more so after this election for the next few cycles, because of they'll take a lot of this personally.
Okay. You think the attack is going to come from the Democrat side, and they're going to say, hey, look a little bit closer to this, maybe perhaps as a wedge issue to get into some of the more devout evangelicals. But the evangelicals, as far as I can read things, the concern that I saw last fall during the primary season that, oh, you know, here we got Santorum, who's not a Mormon, and Romney, who's a Mormon, we'd rather have the not Mormon. All that seems to have subsided some. There's a few people are out there still saying, yeah, I'll never vote for a Mormon, period. But that discussion from the evangelical right-wing side of the political spectrum seems to have subsided. Is that your read?
Yeah, and there have been polls that bear that out. There was a preference in the primaries. The evangelicals, all things considered, would have rather had a non-Mormon candidate.
Yeah.
That is undeniable. But having got through to where we're at, I mean, you know, Robert Jeffress was the pastor who, you know, made the biggest stir during the primaries, talking about how, you know, we can express a preference for, you know, and not vote for a Mormon in the primaries. And everyone said what a bigot he was and how awful this was. And, you know, I don't agree with him, but I stood up for him at the time and I said, look, he's also saying that, you know, this is, I believe we are allowed to express a preference here, but, you know, ultimately, if Mitt Romney is the nominee, I'm going to back him. And, you know, lo and behold, he did. And everybody expressed shock over this when he'd already said that's what he was going to do.
Yeah. I guess they weren't paying attention to that when he said that in the fine
print.
Yeah,
they're too busy being outraged.
Yeah, I can see how that is. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. It definitely, Mitt Romney should carry Utah, right?
I don't know. It could be a nail biter.
It could be a nail biter. I probably won't see him campaigning there. And I oftentimes think about that, right? That kind of sucks if you're in the state of Utah. Nobody ever comes for campaign events here. There's no whistle stop, train stop in Salt Lake City because everybody knows how you're going to go anyways. And the same thing with Wyoming, and you know, nobody lives there anyway. So it just kind of passes you by. Everybody just ends up stopping at Iowa and Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio. Yeah. It's just almost an incentive to become a swing state just so you can get these folks to show up and clog up your traffic, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. If you like clogged traffic, sure.
Yeah. So, okay. Hey, here's another issue that you suggested bringing up, and I hadn't heard about this until you had brought it up, but, you know, you have your pulse on the vein of religious news, or maybe the boot on the neck of the religious news. I don't know. You know this stuff. So I got to ask you about this. It's the issue that we need to cut into. And that's the issue of German circumcision. Now, no idea what's going on there. You got to tell our listeners what is happening with the German circumcision issue.
Oh, good Lord. Yeah. Why did I suggest this? I don't know. There was a court in Germany. Apparently, there was a four-year-old that had undergone some sort of circumcision that didn't go well. There was a court involving a four-year-old that had some sort of circumcision thing done. It didn't go well. And the court ruling had sort of broader implications in terms of banning circumcision. And then this is a problem, and you have, you know, Angela Merkel having to step into the circumcision issue and saying, you know, no, we're not going to deprive, you know, Jews and Muslims of the right of circumcision. You had Jews and Muslims together, you know, pushing against this ruling. And in the U.S., you know, there's been all kinds of fun argument about this.
Yeah, San Francisco brought that up about half a year ago.
San Francisco tried to put this on the ballot, and it got taken off the ballot because they said, look, this is a medical practice and this is regulable at the state level, not at the city level.
Mm-hmm.
That was the excuse used there. But also, it's just this idea of it's seen as being very anti-Semitic, and it should be, you know, you could also say anti-Muslim.
Yeah, this is in Germany after all, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so immediately when you say circumcision, most people, you know, jump to Jews as that's the faith tradition that practices it. But, you know, you're right. And I hadn't really thought about this or realized it until you had brought it up, is that, yeah, Muslims practice this as well. So this is a big religious minority issue.
Yeah. And it kind of goes back to this idea of, you know, religious freedom. It's an individual right that's negotiated collectively.
Mm-hmm.
It's things that you might, as a one-off thing, either agree with or disagree with. But the reason that you say this is a freedom is because the religious community has made a big deal out of it for a long time. And our jurisprudence to this day really doesn't know how to deal with that very well, and I'm not sure it ever will.
Yeah, and it'll probably be an issue that does keep coming up. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it is. I'm sure Angela Merkel, you know, really didn't want to get involved in this. No, that's the platform that I ran on, you know, the circumcision laws and stuff like that. So, yeah, very interesting that this all came up. So we'll have to figure that out. I have one last question that I do want to ask you, and this relates to a podcast that we had a couple weeks ago. Is actually our July 4th podcast airing on July 2nd, where I had three scholars on and we talked about the U.S. War of Independence. And I posed a question to each of these scholars, which was essentially in April of 1775, after the first shots at Lexington and Concord had been fired, would you have picked up a rifle and joined a militia to fight against King George III? And I raised this question because over the past year or so, I'd been asking this question to a number of academics, and surprisingly, most academics would say, no, I would not have, or I would really have to think about it. And this was of Christian academics. So I was, you know, quite surprised to hear that result. So I'm going to pose the same question to you. You're a practicing Christian. So, you know, April 1775, the shots fired at Lexington and Concord, would you have picked up arms to fight against King George III?
Good question. You know, it's funny that was actually put to Bill Buckley by, I want to say it was, I can't remember, was it Huey Lewis? No, it wasn't it. One of the Black Panther founders.
Huey Lewis was the News.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Huey Newton, but yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, he said, Buckley said, well, you know, it's a good question because I do not like revolutions. His dad almost got killed in the Mexican Revolution.
Yeah.
You know, but he said that you know, the American Revolution was not a terribly radical thing, and that, you know, George Washington was a very wise man, and so he supposed he would have supported him. And so I've always found that somewhat persuasive.
Now, that's from a political standpoint, though, and that's, you know, somewhat interesting. Again, you know, the
well,
war has...
I don't believe in revolution for its own sake.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't. Because in that sense, I really am a conservative.
Yeah.
But, you know, I...
Well, a lot of people
tend... I think if you put yourself into the historical moment that America found itself at, yeah, I think I would have sided with the colonists against the crown.
Yeah, see, that's where I put myself as well, too. And, you know, when Buckley talks about revolution, I, you know, people could argue to what extent was it really a revolution, and that's why I refer to it as the U.S. War of Independence. It was a severing of two political systems, and that's the one that severed itself, the colonies in the Americas pretty much kept with the same political structure. They modified it a little bit, wrote a constitution, and the constitution itself was really the Revolutionary Act, more so than the breaking away from the colonies, I guess, although, you know, not many colonies had broken away from that time. But yeah, I said the same thing, but I'm kind of surprised. We had some people, you know, cite Romans 13, verse 1 and to 2 that said, you know, you have to submit to your authority, and that's that, period. So it created a very interesting discussion and controversy. So
yeah, I mean, I think that sort of the thrust of a lot of Christian theology, it changes society over time. You know, I think that the gospel is actually the groundwork for the abolition of slavery, but it took a long time.
Yeah.
You know, and there you do see a tension between the writers of the New Testament, you know, not wanting to run too far afoul of the Roman authorities, but also, you know, they say at certain points you stand your ground, et cetera, and, you know, that's why there were a lot of martyrdoms.
Yep.
You know, and eventually that remade society, and, you know, one of the products of that was, you know, some colonists who decided that, you know, maybe the king wasn't deigned so by God.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's some good thoughts to end up here, and I think we're at our hour mark right now, and that concludes our interview. And I want to remind our listeners to sign up for our Facebook fan page, which we will link to on our website. And also, don't forget about the trivia contest to win a free autographed copy of my latest book, The Political Origins of Religious Liberty. Jeremy, it was great fun talking with you once again, and we hope to have you back to discuss more stuff in the news.
Oh, sure. I'm glad you didn't have the dinner bell, though, because I would be more ravenous than I am right now.
All right. I'm going to have to bring the dinner bell next time we do this. So that's definitely on for next time. So, again, thanks for being part of Research on Religion.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.